Yay.
All right. I don't have a copy of the agenda in front of me, but I believe, let's see, let's go first through, okay, this is the teleconference, the 9/11 and other state, deep state crimes teleconference for April 29th, 2015, Ted Freeland facilitating, and let's see, are there any, okay, Pablo, or, I'm sorry, Craig, go ahead and call the roll, please.
Okay, here's who I have so far. Myself, Ken Freeland, Paul Zaremka, Bill Wilt, Ned Delaney, Mike Cook, Kat McGuire, Dwayne Dietz, Barton Bruce, Wayne Madsen, Pablo Shanes. Did I miss anyone? Okay, then.
Okay, are there any amendments to the minutes as circulated by Craig and
did you add Bill Wilt to that list?
Yeah, I've got you, Bill, yeah.
Okay, thanks. I stepped away for a sec.
Someone's eating. Hope it's tasty.
what is this called? Pozole. It's delicious. Mine is Capoletti. I don't even know what that is. That's one thickness up from Angel hair. Pasta.
You know, Parmesan?
I'm chewing with my mouth closed, by the way.
Oh, boy.
I think we're all lost here.
Yeah. I'm just so glad we got the food part on the recording. That's good to have that preserved.
I'm excited to be on the line with Wayne Madsen.
Yeah.
You call in regularly, or is this what?
Ken, back again. Got bounced. This is going to be one of those nights. So, where were we? Okay, the minutes as circulated by Craig. Any amendments to the minutes? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. And then the draft agenda for tonight, which had two items on it, I think, of special importance. Any amendments? Anything else we need to add to tonight's draft agenda to make it official?
There's chopping going on in the background.
Is there like almost a scratching sound? It's quite periodic and quite annoying.
Yeah.
I think the people that tap the line do that to be annoying.
Somebody's got to take a needle off the record.
Yeah.
Ken, I got like probably a 5-minute important announcement.
Who's this? Pablo?
Pablo?
Yeah, okay. Hi, Pablo. We'll reserve time for that after our other two items. Anything else?
Can we do something to try to find what this noise is? Because it's going to be disruptive the whole meeting if we don't.
You just have to ignore it. It's been my experience.
Is it like a clanging noise? Is that what people are hearing?
It's a scritch kind of noise.
Yeah. Huh.
Click.
Like
no,
a skipping record.
It's clanking, but it's got a sort of a raspiness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Is a record stuck on the spindle?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Well, can you NSA people? Can you NSA people please improve your technology? I mean, this is really annoying. Can't you guys get with the program? I mean, really? You think with all the government money you guys have available, you could do better than this? All right. So, the first item on the agenda would be, I didn't get to hear the roll call because I was not paying attention, but is Ned here with us tonight?
Yes.
Yeah, Ned, I think the first item was yours. That was, you want to go ahead and just introduce it, and we'll go from there.
Okay, well, Wayne was on the teleconference a few months ago in reference to Philip Marshall investigation. So there has been some association with 9/11. What prompted me to contact Wayne recently was legislation that appeared here in Indiana pertaining to religious freedom. And for some reason, it prompted me or threw me into John DeCamp's book, Franklin Covenor. Now, Wayne is mentioned within that investigation, and there are a number of different issues that lead up to 9/11 that for me came out of the book. And one of the key correlations that follow in through various events following the Franklin investigation, Waco, Oklahoma City, 9/11, was complicity and total non-follow-up by the FBI and various federal agencies. So it's kind of my interest in knowing how Wayne felt about that and what he might see in relation to that. For those that don't know Wayne, he's appeared in numerous television, radio shows, various newspaper media. So anyway, I guess I would just throw the floor to Wayne at this point.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm suffering from allergies, so I hope my voice holds up here. So let's give it a go. I've been looking into this whole situation with pedophiles in the government. How I originally got involved with it is when I was on active duty many, many decades ago now. It's hard to believe it's been that long, but in 1982, I was the number three officer in charge of a small submarine tracking station in Oregon, a Navy tracking station. System called SOSA, Sound Surveillance System. And I was approached by the Naval Investigative Service, now called NCIS. That television show, of course, has given it a lot more publicity, probably more than they deserve. And they said that they were doing an investigation of somebody on the base, and then the FBI got involved, and it turns out the target of the investigation was my commanding officer. And he had been fingered by a distributor of child pornography in Chicago who started singing like a canary so he could avoid a lengthy jail sentence and started to turn over the people's names, people he'd been involved with. Well, this was a huge scandal within the Navy, because my commanding officer was not the only naval officer involved. And he certainly, although he was a lieutenant commander, there were many higher-ranking officers that had been implicated, including at least one rear admiral. It might have gone even higher. And the time frame is very, very interesting, because a few years before, there was an investigation by a New York State senator who used the New York detectives because he had discovered that there had been trafficking of underage boys in Greenwich Village, and it had been linked to a similar ring in Washington, D.C. And this was investigated by the state of New York, the legislature, and among others. And by the way, the news on that was broken on at least two major networks at the time, on ABC and on NBC, as lead stories for the evening news broadcast. One of those implicated was then Idaho Representative Larry Craig, who, of course, became quite notorious a few decades later for his toe-tapping antics in the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport. And he resigned his seat as a result of that. But so my involvement in this FBI and NIS sting, I was the lead government witness against my CO, commanding officer, at his court-martial in Seattle, and he was found guilty. He was sentenced to 4 years of hard labor. I found guilty of 21 lewd and lascivious acts with minors. But it was quite clear that the cover-up had already started before the trial was even over. The distribution of child pornography was not part of the charges leveled against them. About 8 years later, we had reports surface, 7 years, maybe 7, 8 years later, reports surfaced in the Washington Times newspaper that there was a huge underage call boy ring involving GOP lobbyists bringing underage congressional pages into the White House for midnight tours. Now, these were front page stories in the Washington Times. It's quite interesting. The Washington Post never covered the story, and actually there was some reporting by the Post ridiculing the Times for picking up the story. Although the Times was owned by Sung Myung Moon, it still employed quite a few people of the former Washington Evening Star. So these were pretty seasoned journalists, investigative reporters that were on the story. But once again, we had congressional pages involved, just like 8 years earlier with the investigation out of New York that linked congressional pages into these this trafficking, pedophile trafficking by members of Congress. We also had the incident where a couple of congressmen got in trouble over their involvement in prostitution ring, male prostitution rings, one being Barney Frank from Massachusetts, the other one being Gary Studs from Massachusetts. Studs admitted to everything. And Frank at the time, it was very interesting, he said if they proceeded to censure him and expel him from the House, that he would name at least 25 members of the House who were also involved in similar activities. Now, here's where you got to be careful, because in those days, being gay was, of course, not as well received as it is today. And what we're talking about is illegal behavior, pedophilia. So, so there was a difference. I don't think Frank had ever been charged. Or it was never implicated in any involvement with underage people, nor was Stutz, although there was some information that he might have been involved with some congressional pages. Okay, move the clock forward. With the Franklin scandal and with John DeCamp. John DeCamp was a Nebraska state senator who had served with William Colby in Vietnam. And it turned out that this Franklin Savings and Loan, which was run by this rising star in the GOP named Lawrence King, Larry King, not to be confused with the television Larry King on CNN, but Lawrence King, who sang the national anthem at a couple of Republican national conventions, was discovered to be involved in a pedophile ring based out of Omaha, which, among other things, was taking underage kids out of Boys Town outside of Omaha and trafficking these children around the country, including into Washington, D.C. DeCamp asked for an investigation, and Nebraska's unicameral legislature had hearings, and they were chaired by the cognizant chairman of the committee, a guy named Lauren Schmidt, who actually last year, I was in Lincoln, Nebraska, and helping a guy run for the U.S. Senate, unfortunately unsuccessfully, and I met Lauren Schmidt, who's like in his late 80s now. I was frankly surprised he's still around, but when I called him, he was happy to talk to me, and he told me some things that were never in some of the things that have been written previously about the Franklin scandal, as it became known as, the Boys Town. It was even rumored that George H.W. Bush was present at some of these functions where there was these underage kids. Schmidt said that he was involved in, he's a Republican, he was involved in a lot of business activities. He's a farmer, as many in Nebraska are. He had also been involved with some deal with one of the Indian reservations on bringing casinos there. Well, lo and behold, what happened was the FBI came to him and said, look, if you proceed with this investigation, we're gonna indict you. We're gonna charge you for all. They, you know, they could indict a ham sandwich if they want to, and that's basically what they told Schmidt to back down. In the interim, the state legislature appointed a special investigator to look into charges of this pedophile network, and they hired a guy named Gary Caradori, who was a professional PI, who flew his own airplane, and he got a tip from Chicago, which I find interesting because the kingpin that was arrested, who tried to do a plea deal with the FBI and turned in the name of my CO in 1982, he was based in Chicago. But anyway, Caradori got a call from a source in Chicago. I got photographs. You know, come up to Chicago. Well, he flew up there with his son, ostensibly to attend a White Sox game, but used the opportunity to pick up apparently some very compromising photographs that could be used by the Nebraska legislature to advance its investigation. High-level individuals who were trafficking in underage children. Mostly boys, but also some girls. And on his way back, flying back from Chicago to Lincoln, his plane crashed over Illinois. He and his son were killed. Everyone, witnesses said they heard a bomb. The FBI, at the same time in Lincoln, stormed into Caradori's office and seized documents. They also went into Lawrence, State Senator Schmidt's office in Lincoln. He was there, and they demanded he turn over documents, and he told them to get the hell out of his office. The briefcase of Caradori's briefcase was actually found at the crash scene, and it was taken by the FBI. All this evidence, of course, disappeared. The investigation sort of came to a grinding halt eventually because the pressure on Lawrence Schmidt was immensely great, and he had been threatened by the FBI with an indictment for something totally unrelated to his investigation. And from what he told me, he was told by certain individuals that the FBI had bombed Caradori's airplane on purpose to make sure that those photographs never reached Lincoln, Nebraska, and the state legislature. Schmidt was defeated for re-election, not surprisingly. But to this day, he is very open about what he believes was a huge cover-up. As I mentioned, DeCamp, who served with Colby, who was a CIA director in the 1970s, arranged to bring Colby into Nebraska to assist in their investigation. And, of course, that never actually happened because the investigation stopped. Colby, of course, in 1996 was found floating near his home on the Chesapeake Bay after he supposedly got up from his hot dinner on the table and decided to go canoeing and suffered a canoeing accident.
Wasn't wearing a life jacket, and he always wore one.
Who's that? Colby?
Yeah.
Well, this gets into, you know, his wife, Sally Shelton, who had been a U.S. ambassador to Barbados. Her reaction to all that was extremely strange, a lot of people thought. And, you know, his body was missing for a couple of days before they actually found it. But she seemed to go along with the official explanation that, you know, he suffered a tragic canoeing accident. A lot of people don't believe that's the case. Now, whether it had to do with his knowledge of the Franklin scandal or it was, you know, Colby had a lot of secrets. He was the head of the Phoenix Project in Vietnam during the Indochina War, and that's where he worked with the camp. Both of them worked on Phoenix. And of course, he had a lot of other secrets because he was probably the last guy to actually see what was known as the full CIA's, what they called the family jewels, all the documents, many of which were destroyed in the final days in office of Richard Helms, the CIA director. And, of course, Colby came in afterwards as a director, and he was eventually let go under, I believe it was Gerald Ford. And eventually he was replaced by George H.W. Bush. Anyway, so we had this Franklin scandal. Franklin was never charged with anything having to do with the pedophile charges. He was charged with defrauding the credit union. So he didn't serve that long in jail. The last I was told, he was in the Washington, D.C. area, Northern Virginia, selling cars at a car dealership in Fairfax County. But he's definitely kept a low profile since he went to prison. And then we move the clock forward to, it seems like almost give or take a few years, every decade there's another explosion in D.C. On these charges because, you know, in the late 90s we had Congressman Mark Foley, a Republican from Florida, charged with trying to pursue underage male pages. That was such a that really put the nail in the coffin of the House Page program because they killed it. This program, which ostensibly was the origin of it, was to get young people in high school in working in the Congress to get them interested in politics in case they wanted to pursue either a political career, go back to Washington as a full-time congressional aide. It was sort of like an educational thing, but these members began abusing the trust the parents put in the Congress to make sure that, you know, nothing happened to their kids while they were there acting as unpaid pages. They lived in dormitories. Foley apparently was caught drunk outside of one of the dormitories, male dormitories, trying to get some of the, you know, young men out of there, young teens. Anyway, he resigned his office, this was a series of events that indicates that there's a lot of blackmail that goes on with these pedophiles. I mean, perhaps the United States isn't the worst because what we now hear from Britain with the Jimmy Savile case, and that goes right up into Buckingham Palace, probably involves Prince Charles, may involve others. Recently, we had a case with Jeffrey Epstein in Florida, and I went to West Palm Beach to look at the court records when underage girls said that they were being flown around on this Epstein's. He's a billionaire from New York, owns an island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. He has a home in New Mexico and a home in West Palm Beach that he was flying underage girls on his private jets. And uh, it, and some of the passengers on those jets when the underage girls were on there for purposes of sex included Bill Clinton and Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard lawyer, and the manifest list came out, and there was quite a few other well-known people who had been flying on these same flights all around the world. There was one of his planes was a Boeing 727, so late-breaking news on that is one of the flight attendants has now come forward and corroborated what was going on some of these flights. So we had also recently Senator Robert Menendez also accused of having liaison with underage girls courtesy of his friend from the Dominican Republic, they've both been indicted, Menendez and his friend, his doctor. But the Dominican Republic, again, is a well-known place for pedophile tourism. I've been told by people in Palm Beach County, Florida, that there is a linkage between Menendez and the Epstein case, the two investigations do cross paths. So what we're talking about here, I don't know how it would apply to 9/11 other than the fact that, you know, we've got people in Congress and high-level politicians who have definitely been compromised by very blackmailable information. And that's a means to exercise control over them. And why that's important for the next election is, in the Epstein case, he was busted in 2007 for soliciting prostitution from a 14-year-old girl. Now, he did a plea deal and agreed to plead guilty to one charge of soliciting prostitution, but it never mentioned of an underage girl. So he got this deal where he got like 9 months in a jail in West Palm Beach, where he would go there at 10 o'clock at night, and he could leave at 6 a.m. He just had to sleep there, and it was basically an apartment. He was also given special leave to actually fly out of the country and go to New York, where he didn't have to be at the jail. So it was a very liberal plea deal. The governor at the time who allowed that plea deal to go through was Jeb Bush. The attorney general was Charlie Crist, who later became the governor of Florida. And, of course, the fact that Bill Clinton was on several of these planes when these underage girls were on there, and while there were reports that Epstein was having sex with underage girls, Bill Clinton was on those same flights, and well, that's problematic for the other presidential candidate, his wife, Hillary Clinton. So we see both major candidates, the GOP and the Democratic candidates, having a lot of involvement with this Epstein case. I could go on and on with all the intricacies of other things that I know about this, but it's a huge problem, and I guess I can answer some questions at this point in time.
Wayne, we certainly want to thank you for taking the time to explore this issue with us. I'm sure there are a number of people on the call that would like to make a comment or ask a question. So, if you'll give me your names, I'll make a list, and we'll go down the list and give you a chance to ask Wayne a question or make a comment. Who'd like to go first?
Well, Ned.
Ned, who else?
Pablo.
Pablo, who else? I'll put my name on the list. Anybody else?
Barton Bruce.
Barton, okay. Anybody else?
Kat McGuire.
Kat, who else? All right, go ahead, Ned. You can start it off.
Okay. Well, I guess I go back to any complicity that Wayne might see in the behavior of the FBI throughout these various incidents. There seems to be regardless of who's heading up the bureau, it seems like this cover-up issue just follows the bureau, the place where national issues that really need to be dealt with, the protection of the public, seem to go ignored or covered up. What do you see as the nature of the bureau, and you know, whether it's the NSA, Homeland Security,
yeah,
you know, what's driving these people? And
well, I think you can tell a lot about an agency based on the number of bona fide whistleblowers that come forward to tell stories of cover-ups, failed investigations, misleading investigations. The FBI has two agents right now who've come forward to talk about gross misconduct by their old bureau. One is Special Agent Michael Dick, and he's filed suit against the FBI. Now, Michael Dick is very interesting because, well, he lives in Annapolis, and he was the part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York, New Jersey before 9/11. And he was the agent assigned the task to investigate the quote-unquote dancing Israelis and urban moving systems over in Weehawken and their activities.
Excuse me. He worked with John O'Neill, correct? And then O'Neill resigned from the Bureau?
Yes, John O'Neill was the special agent in charge in New York. He was de facto the head of the New York, New Jersey Joint Terrorism Task Force. And Michael Dick worked for O'Neill. And O'Neill basically assigned Michael Dick the job of investigating the Israelis. And that investigation was taking place before 9/11. It, of course, really increased after 9/11. And all of a sudden, Michael Dick was pulled off that job and sent over to Pakistan to be the lead agent to investigate the kidnapping of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. But the FBI had already known that he had been executed by his captors. So what I understand, Dick is involved in this this lawsuit, so he's not talking to the media. He refers everybody to the lawsuit, but the lawsuit doesn't really talk about 9/11. It talks about his own problems with the FBI that were obviously brought on by his involvement in the 9/11 investigation. But, you know, they basically tried to set him up as some crazy FBI agent who was threatening to go into the J. Edgar Hoover building and blow his colleagues away. It was totally made up. And the FBI, of course, had to, you know, recant stories that it leaked to Fox News originally to make Dick look bad. He came back from Pakistan, and then he was a reserve officer in the Army and was put on active duty because of the Iraq invasion and occupation. And so he went over there, and when he came back and took on his job, an old job with the FBI, that's when problems started for him. I think probably starting around 2007, 2008. But he has a lot of knowledge, obviously, about what the Israelis were up to in the New York and New Jersey area prior to and after 9/11. A lot of people would not want him to come forward. Now, the other agent, and his name escapes me right now, was in charge of the anthrax investigation for the FBI, and he's recently come forward again in another lawsuit against the FBI and charging the FBI mismanaged the entire anthrax investigation. He's basically said that Bruce Ivins, the Fort Detrick scientist who was charged with being the source of the anthrax, who later supposedly committed suicide, was innocent. And that's quite a revelation coming from the former FBI agent who was in charge of the actual investigation itself. So, you know, you take these two individuals, two bureau agents, and, you know, we can all argue about these agencies, but there are good people who work in the agencies, and I used to work at NSA, and I I've met with good people there who came forward, whistleblowers. You know, some of the names obviously came out. Thomas Drake, Bill Binney, Russ Tice, and there's others. And there's others who never came forward, but who I spoke to, you know, on background, who all said basically the same thing, that NSA covered up a lot of intelligence prior to and after 9/11. And you can say the same, you know, the CIA has its set of whistleblowers. John Kiriakou went to prison, was the guy who blew the whistle on the torture, the waterboarding by the CIA, and there's been other CIA people as well who have come forward. So, yeah, there's a long list of people who have indicted these agencies who were on the inside holding very, very important jobs.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Pablo?
Yeah. Just a quick comment first. It reminded me of my kids always used to say TMI, too much information. It's like, okay, scuzzy stuff is going on, but do we have to hear a half an hour of it? But, of course, it was an excellent presentation. My question for you is, what's your orientation? Do you have a sense of there's a real way, not just putting Band-Aids on a festering wound, but a real way to fix this, short of changing the whole entire system?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to look back at the two times the media really paid attention to this trafficking by pedophiles, high-level people in the government. And it was the early 1980 incident that involved the New York State investigation. And that, as I said, that was those stories led on two networks, on ABC, where it was broken by Frank Reynolds, and on NBC, where it was broken by Roger Mudd. And but what happened is in the intervening years, this came up in the Franklin investigation, and based on some people who were involved in and came forward and talked about the nature of the ring, we found out some names of some very well-known journalists who, in addition to the politicians, were also involved. So no wonder the story never went anywhere, because the media itself was complicit. And the same thing with the Washington Times revelations, which really started to pick up steam. The Washington Times was attacked by the Washington Post, yet some names of people at the Post had also come up as being involved with this investigation, and people with ABC News. So the problem is, without totally independent media, not tied in with these celebrity journalists who get to know these people and get to be too friendly with them, it's very hard to sustain an investigation, not only with the non-cooperation by the federal authorities, but also by interference from the, you know, the head office of these corporate media entities, the Washington Post, the New York Times, ABC News, and others. So the only thing is, you know, with limited resources, I try to keep the investigation going and what happened in Nebraska, but, you know, people are dying now. They're very old. It's a long time ago. And now with this latest thing in West Palm Beach, of course, the federal judge down there basically threw out the charges against Dershowitz and some other names, people that were involved in that. So it looks like some judges have been bought off on that investigation. But it takes like a constant independent media investigation of these things to keep these stories alive. And, you know, with limited budgets, and limited amount of time, and without the major media looking into it, it's very, very difficult to keep these investigations of these subterranean rings going.
Okay. Thanks. This is Ken. I'd like to ask you, Wayne, you answered this question with respect to the narrow issue of 9/11, but if we look at the somewhat larger question of the whole deep state, do you see the pedophile issue as being in some way endemic, or necessarily in some way related to that, or not particular?
Well, we can talk about a lot of unsavory conduct by people in the government. The biggest problem, of course, is people that have sticky fingers when it comes to money. But if you look at all this together, you see we have a compromised Congress, we have compromised cabinet officials, law enforcement officials, and unfortunately even people in the media. But as far as scandals, pedophilia is probably one of the worst taboos, recognized by law enforcement. And yet it seems to be such a big problem, especially, as I mentioned, in Britain, but also there was a recent, of course, 2 years ago, or no, last year, I guess it was, chief of staff for Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee was arrested in Washington for possession of a hard drive full of child pornographic videos and photographs. He was arrested. He was released on the recognizance of his parents who lived in Maryland. And while awaiting arraignment at the D.C. court, he supposedly hanged himself in his parents' basement. Now, I went up to Maryland to investigate that, because Lamar Alexander, former governor of Tennessee, very close friend, education secretary under George H.W. Bush, and I found it to be very problematic that the chief of staff of the former education secretary was in possession of hundreds of thousands of the videos and still photographs of child pornography. But he was part of a bigger ring. They actually nailed him. He was doing business with an outfit out of Toronto, Canada, called As I Film. I'm getting my voice back in an echo. I don't know what's causing that.
Psychedelic
drugs.
Someone
switch to speakerphone or something?
It's psychedelic drugs.
Okay, I don't hear it now. But it's probably NSA using that cheap Stasi equipment they got on surplus deal. But anyway, Azov Films was apparently not only located in Toronto, but they had an operation in Stafford, Virginia now. Anyone who's driven up and down I-95 between Richmond and D.C. will pass by the Stafford Airport, which is probably the biggest hardly used airport on the East Coast. It's a private airport used, you find your Lear jets there. But from Stafford, it's probably about a 30-minute shot into downtown D.C., going a little bit above the speed limit. It's an odd place for an international distributor of child pornography to have located its American headquarters. They arrested the one guy who was in charge of this Azov Films, but his mother, who was really the one who ran the thing, she escaped and nobody knows where she went. This was... Basically, this business was operating in Toronto, and a lot of people knew it was there, including the problematic mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, and we know about his issues. So I'm not saying he was a pedophile, but certainly this guy who was a crackhead was easily blackmailed into maybe allowing this enterprise to
conduct its operations out of his city. And Ryan Loskorn was the name of the chief of staff, and I did a little more investigation into Lamar Alexander. And Lamar Alexander, when he was governor, got involved in privatizing the foster care program in Tennessee and youth camps and orphanages and for his chief of staff. And chief of staff is, like, as important as the member of Congress.
Okay,
the chief of staff really runs everything. Yeah.
Dave, that should suffice, I think, to the response. Let's get in the other two people so that because we're running short on time.
Sure.
Barton wanted to ask you a question. Go ahead, Barton.
I remember, and I wonder if everybody else knows all about her, I'll just stop, but Kay Griggs, Catherine Griggs, who was the divorced wife from a Colonel George Griggs, and she had been a battered wife and eventually divorced him, but there were people in the military, on one hand tried to kill her, on the other hand tried to protect her because she had a Southern general as a cousin, and her brother and father were both colonels in charge of major bases. But her husband was chief of staff for Marine Corps General Al Gray, and he was there's people who selected children who came from sort of dysfunctional families without a good father figure as prime meat for these schools where a lot of children to faculty, you know, activities that were inappropriate were going on. And her husband had been at this Hun school, wherever it is, Pennsylvania maybe, where he was in the special dorm where the dorm master was also the head bodyguard for some of the Arab children who were over here from the Middle East. And it was a very elite school, but they also had some, shall we say, unusual activities they practiced. And so she refers to a whole lot of these as cherry Marines. And once you belong to that club, you have access to all kinds of special privileges and are treated well. And she noticed that on the military base they were on, her husband, although just a colonel like any other colonel, well, he was clearly head and shoulders above the other colonels because they all knew her husband was, you know, something special. But when after the divorce, she found that she had his diary, which he would disappear for days on end and come back at stinking drunk, wandering around house and grounds nude, babbling about who he just assassinated, and she'd read in the newspaper about, you know, Generalissimo something or other somewhere in some faraway country just got popped off, and she knew damn well who did it. But after her divorce, she called into this minister's talk show up in, I'm going to say Minnesota or Michigan or someplace. It was a pastor straw cutter who got her on the phone afterwards after she talked for quite a while and was pretty flabbergasted. And he said, "Lady, that was amazing, but they're going to kill you. I want to depose you on video, you know, as soon as possible. I will pay to fly you up here." So you've got what used to be a whole lot of CDs, but now people repackage it, and sometimes you get the whole thing or in two large segments as a BitTorrent you download. But she goes on for hours and hours and hours, and she refers to people like Henry Kissinger in terms where he seems to like blonde-haired, blue-eyed little boys in the military, and then the next morning tells them, you know, you talk about this, you'll be dead before the day's out, so just shut up and get on with life. And but she refers to him as Heinz, and she's on a first-name basis with a whole lot of people because she was a military brat, born and raised on a military base, and she just knew a phenomenal number of people, and she knew a phenomenal number of details. Mm-hmm. And but she, at one point, was being hidden in the private apartment of some lady, White House reporter, because people were trying to kill her, and friends had taken her to see Bill Colby, who was functioning as a private Washington lawyer at the time, and that was actually very shortly before he was killed. But it was Colby's former subordinate in the military who'd come to see him and who'd had dinner with Colby and his wife. He was the only person out there in wherever it was where all those orphanages were who was a lawyer trying to help these kids who were being all kinds of ways mishandled in the courts. And Colby and his wife were saying, "It's too dangerous. These people are way too powerful. You know, you just can't touch it." And finally, this guy had extracted from Colby a promise to do a very limited amount of research for him, and shortly after that, Colby was dead. I don't think Kay Griggs mentions all that, but I'm tying together various stories. But the Kay Griggs testimony, hours and hours and hours of it, is just riddled with all these little things for these, what she refers to again as cherry Marines, people who have been through various kinds of, shall we say, sexual encounters with other males and whatever all the other games they're playing. And there's a phenomenal amount of that information there, and it seems that there's people in very high places all over the place doing it. And then if you believe some of these other stories that involve people like the Pope, not only the white Pope, which waves from balconies, but the black Pope that's always been a Jesuit general, I guess, who has black masses, and they worship not Satan, but Lucifer, and I don't know what the difference is, and they have real blood sacrifices, and people like the Queen of England probably comes visiting and participates and whatever, you know, whatever. There's all these kinds of things which you don't know, but it makes interesting reading sometimes, and I suspect it's probably more true than not. Anyway, I'm tossing out Kay Greig's name, and if people haven't found it, it should be easily found on the web, and if not, I happily can have copies of a lot of the stuff I've downloaded over the years. It can help anybody find it if they really need it. On the other hand, if someone else, by my speaking of Kay Greig's, if that pump primes anybody else who may have some interesting comments, there's an awful lot of details pointing at things, including, I don't think she calls it that, but she has a nickname in there somewhere for what a lot of people know of is the Black Eagle Trust. It was all the vast amounts of money.
We're fairly short on time because we have another issue we got to deal with. So
okay.
Can we stop
but
it there?
That opens up all kinds of things behind the money, that's behind some of the huge amounts of gold and stuff that was involved in some of the 9/11, other schemes behind the scenes that people made out well on. We're talking huge amounts of gold stolen from the Japanese, stolen from the Chinese. Oh, and also from a lot of European countries after World War II.
Certainly a topic worth delving into in another time, for sure. Okay, Kat, you had a comment or a question? Then we need to move on. Kat, are you still with us? Hello? I guess we lost Kat. She was the last person in the line to talk. So I guess we'll close the topic out there. Wayne, thanks so much for taking the time to share all that valuable information with us tonight and for answering and responding to the questions that we had. We look forward to seeing you back again in the future, if you can make it.
Okay, good talking to you. Take care.
Yeah, really appreciate it, Wayne. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Bye now.
Thanks, Wayne. Goodbye. Okay,
Sorry, I missed that. My speaker was on mute.
Oh, so sorry, Kat. Well, I think we lost you. Are you still there, Wayne?
No, I think he timed out.
I think Wayne left. I'm sorry, Kat. I thought we lost you.
No, that's okay.
Did you want to make a comment, or did you have a question for him?
Oh, maybe next time. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry. All right, so the next item is Paul Zaremka's critique of Rebecca Roth's new book, Methodical Illusion. And Paul, would you like to say a few words, and then we'll open it up for discussion? I assume Paul's with us. Paul, are you with us tonight? Paul Zaremka?
Hello?
Paul?
Hello. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you now. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. So let me just say, I didn't know anything about Rebecca Roth's book until about a month ago, or a little bit less than a month ago, I'm not sure, but I found it on Craigslist. It was mentioned by somebody who was quite enthusiastic initially about it, and so I wound up starting to listen to some of her interviews, and then I went and read the book on the Kindle version of the book, which is the second edition, and she makes a very strong statement about what happened on 9/11 to the planes. And I mean, she's not giving the whole story. She's giving the story about the planes. And the bottom line is that all four planes left. Now, this is important, that from her point of view, you take as given certain pieces of evidence that the government has provided, namely the times that the planes left, and the times that the first phone calls were made from anyone, allegedly, from any one of those planes. It's very important to recognize that she's starting from that premise, which actually is an interesting idea. It's an interesting way to approach things. And I think the reason why she's approaching that as a former flight attendant is that she, as she listens to some of these flight attendants, she is absolutely convinced that these are real people talking to other real people, and that there's no morphing involved. And in fact, I think she even considers it an insult to consider the possibility that these voices are morphed. Okay, so that's all very interesting. And then I went through and listened to, a whole number of the interviews. They're very repetitious, except, of course, each time there's some variation from one thing or another. Something is added on, something is subtracted from the last one, because it depends upon what questions are asked and stuff like that. But anyway, over and over she says that the book describes the truth about what happened at 9/11. Even though it's a novel, that portion of the book which describes 9/11 is the truth. And as with a capital T in this case, by the way, because she really says that she has the truth. Or sometimes she refers to we, not exactly being clear who we are. But anyway, so I did some checking. Now, one of the things that bothered me is there's a huge amount of people on the Internet who are interviewing her, and I've only seen one and maybe a part, and certainly like one other who asks, let's slow down and just talk through the evidence. And most of them seem wildly enthusiastic about the conclusion that all four planes landed in Westover Air Force Base, Massachusetts, in time to have all but the people who were on the phone calls gassed in the plane. The people who were on the phone calls were taken up to a hangar upstairs in the Air Force Air Reserve Base, and were presumably somehow guided to what to say. But I think she wouldn't say they were scripted in the sense of, you know, they didn't read a script right in front of them, I don't think. In fact, I don't think that's very effective. I think she's right that they were told more or less what to say, but sort of did it in their own way, which I think, you know, accounts for lots of variations. Anyway, so she looks at all these things that particularly the flight attendants are saying and finds out that basically it could not have happened on a plane. Okay, all that makes sense. So, although I will say that there's many people who have questioned whether those voices made sense or not. I mean, she's by no means I think that from the get-go, many people were questioning what was said, but she's questioning from the point of view of being a flight attendant, which is important. So anyway, and she has a manner about her which is attractive. I mean, she sounds relaxed. She so forth and so on. Okay. So anyway, so I just said, well, she claims that the book has the truth. So how does she get to the quote proof, which is for her, it is a proof that the planes landed in time for the phone calls to be made from the hangars. Given that you accept the time that the plane took off and you accept the time that the first phone call was made, and I can elaborate. Maybe people are going to want me to elaborate, but basically I found out for the two American airline planes, the times don't work. I mean, it doesn't compute is the phrase I have, which means what? It means that in both the American Airlines 11 case, and which is the Betty Ong, the first call is Betty Ong, and in the flight American Airlines 77, which is Renee May, both of those calls are made when the plane would still be in the air, maybe getting low enough to make a cell phone call from the plane, but probably not, and probably going too fast not to be able to sustain a call. And those calls, the on-call went on for quite a long time, and the Renee May phone call went on for about, I think, 3 minutes, which would be too long. Now, I can go through the details of it. I don't know if if you want me to do that or take questions or whatever.
Well, have most folks read Paul's critique with these with this information on the internet, or would anybody have folks not seen it yet?
This is Mike. Mike Cook.
Yeah, Mike.
Pablo.
Who else?
Pablo.
I got it.
Okay,
well, I mean,
I was going to go ahead. Just a couple of quick points.
No, we're not opening for comments here. We're trying to find out if people are familiar with these details or if we should have Paul go into them.
I am pretty familiar. I was all up on pilots for 9/11 Truth.
Okay, is anybody on the call not familiar with these details and needs Paul to elaborate at this point, or can we let Paul just begin generality?
This is Ned. I'm just vaguely familiar with the issue at hand. So
if you just
take a few minutes to update, but not
all right.
A lot.
All right. So I guess we have at least one person that has not read the article, Paul. We'd appreciate it.
Okay. The key is, the key is, how does she prove that the planes arrived in time for the first phone call to be on the ground? And that means not just landed on the ground, but get out of the plane, walk or run or whatever, to the inside a hangar, up the stairs of the hangar, go into an office, make a phone call after you've received some instructions. You can all decide for yourselves how long you think that might be. Let's say it's 5 minutes. I don't know what a realistic number is. It depends upon whether you think the instructions could have been made ahead of time or whatever. But anyway, what she does in her book, and remember, the book says that what she says about 9/11 is correct. What the book says is, you can figure out how long it takes for a plane to go from Boston, for example, from Boston to Westover Air Force Base by going to a site called airplanemanager.com. It then has a choice for what kind of plane you're in, what kind of wind conditions you have, and it'll tell you how long it takes to get there. For Flight 11, going from Boston to Westover Air Reserve Base, it says 21 minutes. It doesn't say exactly whether it means wheels off or wheels off, wheels on, but it has to mean wheels off, wheels on, because you don't know what gate it would go from Logan Airport or any other airport that you're using that airplane manager for. You don't know what gate it's going from, so it couldn't be from a generic gate. It has to be wheels off to wheels on. And furthermore, I did some just double checking of very short flights, ones going from Newark to either JFK or to LaGuardia, and it could only be wheels off to wheels on. So that means that the 21 minutes is wheels off to wheels on, and that means that the plane is going to arrive, if it left at 7:59, it would arrive at 8:20 if the wind is neutral. The wind, if it's not a headwind or a tailwind, on that particular, and the book says to use no wind. On that particular day, actually, I checked out the wind conditions. It was somewhat of a headwind, but it maybe not enough to make a difference, but it wasn't a tailwind. So it would land at 8:20, or at best, maybe 8:21. The first phone call is supposed to be 8:18, but from Betty Ong, 8:18:18. So if you add 5 minutes to 8:20, that makes 8:25, and it's the distance, the spread is too large. The American Airlines Flight 11 is, 77 is more problematic because she, in her book, doesn't say what kind of wind conditions she's using, but she says it takes 52 minutes, but it takes 57 minutes if it's neutral wind. If it's a headwind, obviously it'd be a bit more. If it's a tailwind, it'd be less. The tailwind could lead it to be 57 seconds, a minute, sorry, which is what she implies in the book. I mean, what she says, sorry, she says it in the book, 57 minutes. But in fact, it does not have a tailwind in that day. It had somewhat of either a crosswind or a headwind. So you have to take 57 minutes, not 52 minutes. And that's 5 minutes before, excuse me, that's 5 minutes after Renee made her call, which is around 9:13 or 9:12, depending upon her the interview of her parents, which was who were interviewed three different times. All three interviews said the same thing, and these are FBI reports, which is the kinds of reports that Rebecca Roth mostly relies upon. So I mean, I have more things, but I guess that's the rub of it. So my problem is, it can't happen that way. So something has to give. Either the planes left earlier, or the calls came later. I mean, but when I ask her those kinds of questions, she won't give an inch on that kind of issue because she's using the documents that say that. And as I said, that on one hand, I kind of respect that, but on the other hand, it doesn't quite work. And therefore, I'm puzzled by what's going on.
All right. Paul, thank you for a very comprehensive overview there. Would anybody like to make a quick comment or ask a brief question of Paul regarding this critique?
Mike? Cook?
I'm sorry?
Mike?
Okay, who else?
Pablo.
Pablo, who else? Okay.
Yeah,
Mike,
Ned,
go ahead.
If there's time, I do have a question.
Who's this?
Ned?
Yeah, okay. All right, so Mike, go ahead first.
Hey, thanks. I'm a big fan of Pilots for 9/11 Truth. They're the experts in that field, just as architects and engineers are the expert in their fields. And I was impressed with a lot of things they did. They, you know, put guys that had all kinds of time on those actual planes in the simulators and failed to hit the buildings and so forth. And they have all of the data that's available from a whole bunch of different sources, actually, it turns out, for where planes were flying and when. They got all that radar tracking down. And they had different ideas about where the planes were switched. The plane switching was mentioned in Operation Northwoods. And it's very simple from a radar perspective. One plane lands and another plane takes off at the same airport about the same time and just kind of takes over that blip on the screen. You may think it's the same plane, but it's not.
Right.
And different airports with the flight paths crossing right over the Air Force base than what Susan has. So I'm skeptical about that portion of Susan's story. But I think she does add an awful lot with the airline attendant perspective. My brother and my sister-in-law, former sister-in-law, were in American Airlines for many years and knew the business pretty inside and out. And what she has to say as far as how the attendants would react is spot on. So, yeah. Very, very strange things happened there. And I shudder to think, actually, about what may have happened to the passengers because I know they like to have live human subjects to do their mind control experiments on. You know, they were picking them up off the street during MK Ultra. And a plane load of people would not necessarily be killed, but be used as science experiments. You know, it's very grim, but there it is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Papa?
Yeah, what I would just say is that if you're interested in this question of the timing, Paul did a sensational job, an expert job in the written stuff, in the discussion that we were linked to, and you can't compete with that on the air. So anybody that's interested should go to that link because he nails the stuff.
Who's speaking now?
That was Pablo.
Okay.
And what was who do we need to look up again?
The link we were given before this program.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Paul's critique itself, which was mentioned in the draft agenda. Okay, the link was provided there. Okay, everybody.
Right, right, yeah.
Okay, and then finally, Ned, do you have a comment or a question real quick?
Yeah, I was under the impression, maybe somebody's familiar with the data that came in suggesting that one of the flights, I don't have the numbers, landed in Cleveland. In other words, supposedly there were witnesses that saw a flight that...
That was in the first Loose Change movie.
Okay. Was there any discussion about that in... I confess that I only spot read the material, so...
Yeah, I didn't get to read it at all. My online capacity has been diminished, and my time is very short. Working long hours, it's hard to be up this late.
So the question I think was to Paul, does Rebecca Roth deal at all with this report about the landing in Cleveland or no?
She responds, and I can't remember how she phrases it, but she doesn't think it's credible in any way whatsoever.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And thanks again, Paul, for your work on this really current topic. Roth's book is really out there, and it really is something we should be paying attention to for whatever reason. Okay, and then we have just enough time left for Pablo. You have you said you wanted about 5 minutes to make an announcement?
Yes, please. I'm the director of two different projects that are related but independent. One is the 9/11 crash test project, and I'm supposed to report whenever I show up at these calls. Let me just quickly say that we got tied down with a double problem of we're an international team. Some of our people are not in the same countries as others, and we're using different software, and the two programs could not communicate, so that just shut everything down. And then we have language problems. So something I never expected really has hung up the 9/11 crash test project, but we're finally making some breakthroughs on that. So we'll have more to report in the future. My other capacity is as kind of owner, lead moderator, founder of a thing called the 9/11 Truth Dialogue Forum. It goes HTTP, et cetera, www.911truthdialogue.com. And the point of this forum is essentially to try to be a place where everybody in the 9/11 truth movement can address three ways of looking at 9/11. One is covering the nine essential, I call them nine or 11, depending if you include anthrax, the Patriot Act, and Afghanistan. Nine or 11 essential components of the 9/11 big lie. So it's really easy to remember. So our first of three forums is just focusing on the nine essential components and trying to nail down a common statement across the whole entire 9/11 truth movement. And I think we all already agree about those points, but we're not uniting on it, and we're not taking that united message to the people, and that's why we're not as effective as we should be, and instead we're fighting over what happened instead of our onus being just proving that we were lied to. That's all we have to prove, and then the people will act. So there's a kind of a minimum forum that focuses on just the main nine points. Then there's a full forum that focuses on all 250 details. And then the third form is the alternative or, you know, alternative theories that aren't, that didn't come from the government, like it's the billionaires, it's the deep state, it's the lizard people, it's the, well, any theory, people put out their own position. Now, the guidelines for this forum are that it's going to be teamwork across the whole 9/11 truth movement. We talked about this idea in a recent teleconference. I've gone ahead and set up a forum to do that. The second thing is that there's going to be no sectarianism allowed. Everything's going to be fully moderated. Any post that comes in and attacks anybody, we take that part out and post the rest of it. We're just not going to allow any sectarianism after almost a decade and a half of everybody doing flame wars on everybody else. And the third thing is it's going to be super logically organized so that people can discuss things in a logical way. Whatever they want to talk about, there'll be a sub-forum to address that issue, and that'll be the only thing discussed there. And so if you go to 9/11 Truth Dialogue Forum, you'll see two-thirds on the left a column and one-third on the right a column. I want to just address the two-thirds on the left. It starts off, it says forum, topics, post, freshness, growth, the top. Then it says zero, welcome to our front page. This left-hand column is divided into two main sections, above and below the long solid line. Above it are our three forms that I just mentioned, the place, the places for all the work and discussion. Below it are our draft 9/11 Truth Movement unifying statement, where I've spelled out, you know, fleshed out in words these nine components and what's wrong with the official version. And that would be, that's a draft, and hopefully the whole 9/11 Truth Movement will come in and make it final so we can take it to the world. And then that's followed by some form guidelines. I just mentioned the three guidelines. Our key focus, which is on the focusing on the nine key elements of the lie, and then two proposed extra projects, which is a world petition drive to start 9/11 this year, 4+ months from now, and a year later, a world vote. Let the people who are the only ones that have the right to decide whether we're going to be completely a world full of police states and wars or whether we're going to do something different. So a petition, we did that 50 years ago in San Diego against the war in Vietnam. We got 100,000 signatures, and it changed things because people signed something and said, enough of this slaughter. So these are ideas that I haven't seen anybody come up with, but I think they're worthy. The main thing, my point being just that we're hoping that everyone will participate in this forum from the perspective that this is the one place that's like sanctified, where there's going to be no warring. Nobody's going to be tearing anybody up. We're going to work together to come up with a joint statement that's based on the truth, that some minimum moral principles are involved, that lays out that 9/11 was completely proven a lie. Take that to the people, and the people do something about it. So that's my presentation.
Well, Papa, who's sponsoring this website?
Well, Steve Dayak, who's basically finances the 9/11 crash test, has been financing this, but this is my project, and we always announce that the two are related but separate. So I'm responsible for everything about this. Steve's financing it because I don't have any money.
Got it. Okay, thank you. All right, does anybody else wish to comment or ask a question regarding Pablo's report?
Yes, Craig.
Craig, anybody else? Okay, go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, Pablo, what I'm hearing you say sounds really good about the idea of not allowing fighting to go on and to really try to come together on some of these things. But I want to ask you, my impression of Steve Dayak is that he seems to focus a lot on attacking just about every single person in the movement besides himself. And I find that to be, I find his attitude to be very destructive, and I'm just trying to figure out how to put the two together, that he's involved in something where there's no fighting, and yet it seems like that's all he does is attack other truthers. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I'm so glad that you asked that question. I have tremendous respect for this guy because of the incredible video he did about War Without End, Tired of War Without End, and because, like no one else I know in the last 14 years, he has concentrated on the gashes at the three different places and the forensics of them. This is a leading thing. On the other hand, he's the champion sectarian MF-er in the whole goddamn movement, and he admits it. So I'm the opposite of that, and we have our little showdowns periodically within our little committees because I just won't put up with it. And he just doesn't seem to be able to stop. He's got a taste for warring, like so many people do. That's not me, people. I got 50 years of building unity. 50, 40 years ago, we had 100 different groups working together, meetings once a week of 300 people. I helped share that. And we forged unity and helped stop the war in Vietnam despite all the police sabotage, all those problems. So I'm the opposite of Steve Dayak when it comes to, I mean, his videos are great, but when he's dealing with people directly, he goes to war. And it's always everybody else's fault and not his. Well, everybody says the same thing. Yeah, I'm the opposite of that. People can be guaranteed the one thing. I'm going to find a way to work with people no matter what their position is because we're focusing on what didn't happen.
So you're going to run it rather than him in terms of how it actually functions and as a forum.
Exactly. He's got no say over it whatsoever.
Good to know. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the question because that point needed to be made.
Yeah.
Okay,
he's made my life so hard because he says to me, well, I burned every bridge there is. Let's see if you can fix any of them. And that's how I'm put in a position where I have to talk about him with everybody because everybody's had bad experiences with him. It's a shame. It's sad. but we're stuck with that. Let's rebuild.
Okay. Pablo, thank you again for updating us and keeping us informed about the much beleaguered but hopefully still hopeful 9/11 crash test. And we'll look forward to more reports in the future from you. And I think that's it for tonight. It's already 9:30 Eastern Time. So it's time to wrap it up. But thank you all for your participation tonight. Thank you for all of you who made presentations. And we'll see you next month, last Wednesday of the month, at the same time in the same place. Good night.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Ken.
Bye.
Bye.